At the end of the campaign, Nelson put on a television ad that was misleading but effective. The announcer raised a series of issues and asked what I would do about them. To each question, my own voice answered, "Raise and spend." Nelson's campaign had lifted those three words from a section in my State of the State address in which I had compared Arkansas's budget with that of the federal government. While Washington could engage in deficit spending, if we didn't have the money, we had to raise and spend or not spend at all. I put out a response ad comparing Nelson's claim to what I had really said, and told the voters that if they couldn't trust Nelson not to mislead them in the campaign, they couldn't trust him to be governor. A couple of days later, I was reelected, 57-43%. The victory was sweet in many ways. The people had decided to let me serve 14 years, longer than any other Arkansas governor in history, and for the first time, I had carried Sebastian County, which was then still the most hardcore Republican big county in the state. In a campaign appearance in Fort Smith, I had promised that if I did win there, Hillary and I would dance down Garrison Avenue, the town's main street. A couple of nights after the election, along with a few hundred supporters, we kept our commitment. It was cold and raining, but we danced away and enjoyed every minute of it. We had waited 16 years for a general election win there. The only really dark moment of the general election was purely personal. In August, Mother's doctor discovered a lump in her right breast. 48 hours later, while Dick, Roger, and I waited in the hospital, Mother had the lump removed. After the procedure, she was her usual chipper self and was back at work on the campaign in no time, though she faced months of chemotherapy. The cancer had already spread to 27 nodes in her arm, but she didn't tell anyone this, including me. In fact, she never told us how bad it was until 1993. In December, I resumed my work for the Democratic Leadership Council, launching the Texas DLC chapter in Austin. In my speech, I argued that, contrary to our liberal critics, we were good Democrats. We believed in keeping the American dream alive for all people. We believed in government, though not in the status quo. And we believed government was spending too much on yesterday and today, interest on debt, defense, more money for the same health care, and too little on tomorrow, education, the environment, research and development, the infrastructure. I said the DLC stood for a modern, mainstream agenda, the expansion of opportunity, not bureaucracy, choice in public schools and child care, responsibility and empowerment for poor people, and reinventing government, away from the top-down bureaucracy of the industrial era, to a leaner, more flexible, more innovative model appropriate for the modern global economy. I was trying to develop a national message for the Democrats, and the effort fueled speculation that I might enter the presidential race in 1992. During the recent campaign, I had said on more than one occasion that I would serve out my term if elected. That's what I thought I would do. I was excited about the coming legislative session, though I strongly disagreed with many of his decisions, like killing the Brady Bill and vetoing the Family and Medical Leave Act. I liked President Bush and had a good relationship with the White House. Also, a campaign to defeat him looked hopeless. Saddam Hussein had invaded Kuwait, and the United States was beginning its buildup for the Gulf War, which in 2 months would drive the president's approval ratings into the stratosphere. On the morning of January 15, 1991, with 10-year-old Chelsea holding the Bible for me, I took the oath of office in Little Rock for the last time. Following the custom, I delivered my informal address in the crowded chamber of the House of Representatives, then at noon made a more formal address at the public ceremony, which was held in the Capitol Rotunda because of inclement weather. The new legislature had more women and blacks than ever. The Speaker of the House, John Lipton, and the President pro tempore of the Senate, Jerry Brookout, were progressives and strong supporters of mine. Jim Guy Tucker was lieutenant governor, probably the ablest person ever to hold the job, and we were working together rather than at cross purposes for the first time in years. I dedicated my inaugural address to the men and women from Arkansas serving in the Persian Gulf, and noted that it was appropriate that we were making a new beginning on Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday, because we must go forward into the future together, or we will all be limited in what we achieve. Then I outlined the most ambitious program I had ever proposed in education, health care, highways, and the environment. In education, I proposed a big increase in adult literacy and training programs, apprenticeships for non-college-bound youths, college scholarships for all middle-class and low-income kids who took the required courses, made a B average, and stayed off drugs, preschool programs for poor kids, a new residential high school for math and science students, conversion of 14 VOTEC schools into two-year colleges, and a $4,000 raise for teachers over 2 years. I asked the legislature to raise the sales tax 0.5 cent and the corporate income tax 0.5% to pay for them. There were also several reform measures in my package, including health insurance for pregnant women and for children, the removal of more than 250,000 taxpayers, more than 25% of the total, from the state income tax rolls, and an income tax credit to offset the sales tax increase for up to 75% of the taxpayers. And for the next 68 days, I worked to pass the program, bringing legislators to my office, going to their committee hearings to argue personally for bills, cornering them in the halls at nighttime events or early in the morning at the Capitol cafeteria, hanging around with them outside the chambers or in the cloakrooms, calling them late at night, and bringing opposing legislators and their allied lobbyists together to hammer out compromises. By the end of the session, virtually my entire program had passed. The tax proposals received between 76 and 100% of the vote in both houses, including the votes of a majority of Republican lawmakers. Ernest Dumas, one of the state's most distinguished and astute columnists, said, "For education, it was one of the best legislative sessions in the state's history, arguably the best." Dumas noted that we also passed the largest highway program ever, greatly expanded health care for poor families, improved the environment by passing proposals for solid waste recycling and reduction, and for weakening the hand of polluting industries at the state's Pollution Control Agency, and spurned a few religious zealots by providing school health clinics in poor communities. The legislature had its biggest fight over the school health clinics. I favored allowing the clinics to distribute condoms if the local school board approved. So did the Senate. The more conservative House was devoutly anti-condom. Finally, the legislature adopted a compromise offered by Representative Mark Pryor, who in 2002 became Arkansas's junior U.S. Senator. No state money could be used to buy condoms, but if bought with other funds, they could be distributed. Bob Lancaster, a witty columnist for the Arkansas Gazette, wrote a hilarious article chronicling the struggle of the Condom Congress. He called it, with apologies to Homer, the Trojans War. The legislature also passed the National Rifle Association's bill to prohibit cities and counties from adopting local gun control ordinances, the same measure I had vetoed in 1989. No Southern legislature could say no to the NRA. Even in the more liberal Senate, this bill passed 26-7. At least I got the Senate to pass it late, so I could veto it after they went home and they couldn't override it. After the bill was sent to me, I had an extraordinary encounter with the young NRA lobbyist who came down from Washington to push the bill. He was very tall and well-dressed and spoke with a clipped New England accent. One day he stopped me as I was crossing the rotunda from the House to the Senate side of the Capitol. "Governor, Governor, why don't you just let this bill become law without your signature?" I explained for the umpteenth time why I didn't support the bill. Then he burst out, "Look, Governor, You're going to run for president next year, and when you do, we're going to beat your brains out in Texas if you veto this bill. I knew I was getting older and more seasoned when I didn't slug him. Instead, I smiled and said, "You don't get it. I don't like this bill. You know gun control will never be a problem in Arkansas. You've just got a chart on the wall in your fancy office in Washington with this bill at the top and all the states listed below. You don't give a damn about the merits of this bill. You just want to put a check by Arkansas on that chart. So you get your gun and I'll get mine. We'll saddle up and meet in Texas." As soon as the legislature went home, I vetoed the bill. Soon afterward, the NRA began running television ads attacking me. It wasn't until I began writing this account that I realized that in my confrontation with the NRA lobbyist, I had acknowledged that I was considering running for president. At the time, I didn't think there was a chance I'd do it. I just didn't like to be threatened. After the session, Henry Oliver told me he wanted to leave. I hated to lose him, but after decades of proud service in the Marines, the FBI, and local and state government, he had earned the right to go home. For the time being, Gloria Cabe and Carol Rasco took over his responsibilities. I spent the next few months making sure our massive legislative program was well implemented and traveling the country for the Democratic Leadership Council. Because I was out there making the case for how we could regain mainstream middle-class voters who have left the party in droves for 20 years, the press continued to speculate that I might run in 1992. In an interview in April, I joked about it, saying, "As long as nobody runs, everybody can be on the list, and it's kind of nice. It makes my mother happy to read my name in the paper." While I still didn't believe I could or should run, and President Bush's approval ratings were still above 70% in the afterglow of the Gulf War, I was beginning to think a DLC Democrat who could relate both to the party's traditional base and to swing voters might have a chance, because the country had serious problems that weren't being addressed in Washington. The president and his team seemed determined to coast to victory on the wings of the Gulf War. I had seen enough in Arkansas and in my travels around the country to know America couldn't coast through four more years. As 1991 unfolded, more and more people came to share that view. In April, I went to Los Angeles to speak to a luncheon for Education First, a citizens group dedicated to improving public education.
End of Disc 16. Disc 17.
In April, I went to Los Angeles to speak to a luncheon for Education First, a citizens group dedicated to improving public education. After Sidney Poitier introduced me, I recounted three recent experiences with education in California that reflected both promise and peril for America's future. The promise I had seen more than a year earlier when I spoke at California State University in Los Angeles to students with roots in 122 other nations. Their diversity was a good omen for our ability to compete with and relate to the rest of the global community. The perils were evident when Hillary and I visited with sixth graders in East Los Angeles. They were great kids who had big dreams and a deep desire for normal lives. They told us their number one fear was of being shot going to and from school. They also said they did practice drills crouching under their desks in the event of a drive-by shooting. The children's number two fear was that when they turned 13, they would have to join a gang and smoke crack cocaine or face severe beatings from their contemporaries. My experience with those kids had a profound impact on me. They deserved better. On another California trip, this time to discuss education with the Business Roundtable, a telephone company executive told me that 70% of his job applicants flunked the company's entrance examination, even though virtually all of them were high school graduates. I asked the audience if the United States, fresh from victory in the Gulf War, could hope to lead the post-Cold War world if childhood was dangerous and our schools were inadequate. Of course, it was one thing to say the country had problems, and quite another to say what the federal government should do about them, and to say it in a way that could be heard by citizens conditioned by the Reagan-Bush years to believe the federal government was the source of our problems, not the solution. Making that case was the mission of the Democratic Leadership Council. In early May, I went to Cleveland to preside over the DLC convention. A year earlier, in New Orleans, we had issued a statement of principles intended to move beyond the tired partisan debate in Washington by creating a dynamic but centrist progressive movement of new ideas rooted in traditional American values. While the DLC had been criticized for being too conservative by some of the party's leading liberals, like Governor Mario Cuomo and the Reverend Jesse Jackson, who said DLC stood for Democratic Leisure Class, the convention attracted an impressive array of creative thinkers, innovative state and local officials, and business people concerned about our economic and social problems. Many prominent national Democrats, including several prospective presidential candidates, were also there. Among the speakers were Senators Sam Nunn, John Glenn, Chuck Robb, Joe Lieberman, John Breaux, Jay Rockefeller, and Al Gore. Besides me, the governors there were Lawton Childs of Florida and Jerry Beliles of Virginia. The House members there mostly represented conservative constituencies, like Dave McCurdy of Oklahoma, or had an interest in national security and foreign policy, like Steve Solars of New York. Former Senator Paul Tsongas and former Governor Doug Wilder of Virginia, both of whom would soon be running for president, were there. A number of talented black leaders participated, including Governor Wilder, Mayor Mike White of Cleveland, Vince Lane, the creative chairman of the Chicago Housing Authority, Congressman Bill Gray of Pennsylvania, and Congressman Mike Espy of Mississippi. I opened the convention with a keynote address designed to make the case that America needed to change course and that the DLC could and should lead the way. I began with a litany of America's problems and challenges and a rebuke of the years of Republican neglect, then noted that the Democrats had not been able to win elections despite Republican failures because too many of the people that used to vote for us, the very burdened middle class we are talking about, have not trusted us in national elections to defend our national interest abroad, to put their values into our social policy at home, or to take their tax money and spend it with discipline. I applauded the leadership of the Democratic Party under Ron Brown, our first black chairman, whom I had supported. Brown had made a real effort to broaden the party's base, but we needed a message with specific proposals to offer the American people. The Republican burden is their record of denial, evasion, and neglect, but our burden is to give the people a new choice rooted in old values, a new choice that is simple, that offers opportunity, demands responsibility, gives citizens more say, provides them responsive government, all because we recognize that we are a community. We are all in this together, and we are going up or down together. The Opportunity Agenda meant economic growth through free and fair trade, as well as more investment in new technologies and in world-class education and skills. The Responsibility Agenda required something of all citizens, national service for young people in return for college aid, welfare reforms that required able-bodied parents to work but provided more support for their children, tougher child support enforcement, more efforts by parents to keep their kids in school, a reinvented government with less bureaucracy and more choices in child care, public schools, job training, elderly care, neighborhood policing, and the management of public housing. The community agenda required us to invest more in our millions of poor children and to reach across the racial divide to build a politics based on lifting up all Americans, not dividing them against one another. I tried hard to break through all the either-or debates that dominated national public discourse. In the conventional Washington wisdom, you had to be for excellence or equity in education, for quality or universal access in health care, for a cleaner environment or more economic growth, for work or child rearing and welfare policy, for labor or business in the workplace, for crime prevention or punishing criminals, for family values or more spending for poor families. In his remarkable book, Why Americans Hate Politics, the journalist E.G. Dionne labels these as false choices, saying in each instance that Americans thought we should not choose either or, but both. I agreed and tried to illustrate my beliefs with lines like, "Family values will not feed a hungry child, but you cannot raise that hungry child very well without them. We need both." I wound up the speech by citing the lesson I had learned in Professor Carol Quigley's Western Civilization class more than 25 years earlier, that the future can be better than the past, and that each of us has a personal, moral responsibility to make it so. That is what the new choice is all about. That is what we are here in Cleveland to do. We are not here to save the Democratic Party. We are here to save the United States of America. That speech was one of the most effective and important I ever made. It captured the essence of what I had learned in 17 years in politics and what millions of Americans were thinking. It became the blueprint for my campaign message, helping to change the public focus from President Bush's victory in the Gulf War to what we had to do to build a better future. By embracing ideas and values that were both liberal and conservative, it made voters who had not supported Democratic presidential candidates in years listen to our message. And by the rousing reception it received, the speech established me as perhaps the leading spokesman for the course I passionately believed America should embrace. Several people at the convention urged me to run for president, and I left Cleveland convinced that I had a good chance to capture the Democratic nomination if I did run, and that I had to consider entering the race. In June, my friend Vernon Jordan asked me to go with him to Baden-Baden, Germany, to the annual Bilderberg Conference, which brings together prominent business and political leaders from the United States and Europe to discuss current issues and the state of our transatlantic relationship. I always enjoyed being with Vernon and was stimulated by my conversations with the Europeans, including Gordon Brown, a brilliant Scottish Labour Party member who would become Chancellor of the Exchequer when Tony Blair was elected Prime Minister. I found the Europeans generally supportive of President Bush's foreign policies, but very concerned by the continued drift and weakness of our economy, which hurt them as well as us. At Bilderberg, I ran into Esther Coopersmith, a Democratic activist who had served as part of our UN delegation during the Carter years. Esther was on her way to Moscow with her daughter Connie, and she invited me to join them to observe firsthand the changes that were unfolding in the last days of the Soviet Union. Boris Yeltsin was about to be elected president of the Russian Republic, with an even more explicit repudiation of Soviet economics and politics than Gorbachev had espoused. It was a brief but interesting trip. When I got back to Arkansas, I was convinced that a lot of America's challenges in foreign relations would involve economic and political issues that I understood and could handle if I were to run and actually become president. Still, as July dawned, I was genuinely torn about what to do. I had told Arkansans in the 1990 election that I would finish my term. The success of the 1991 legislative session had given me a new burst of enthusiasm for my job. Our family life was great. Chelsea was happy in a new school with good teachers, good friends, and her passion for ballet. Hillary was doing well in her law practice and enjoyed great popularity and respect in her own right. After years of high-tension political struggles, we were settled and happy. Moreover, President Bush still looked unbeatable. An early June poll in Arkansas showed that only 39% of the people wanted me to run, and that I would lose my own state to the president, 57-32%, with the rest undecided. Moreover, I wouldn't be stepping into an empty primary field. Several other good Democrats seemed likely to run, so the nomination fight was sure to be hard. And history was against me. Only one governor of a small state had ever been elected president, Franklin Pierce of New Hampshire in 1852. Beyond the political considerations, I genuinely liked President Bush and appreciated the way he and his White House had worked with me on education. Though I strongly disagreed with his economic and social policies, I thought he was a good man and nowhere near as ruthless or right-wing as most of the Reaganites. I didn't know what to do. In June, on my trip to California, I was picked up at the airport and driven to my speech by a young man named Sean Landrus. He encouraged me to run for president and said he had found the perfect theme for the campaign. He then put on a tape of Fleetwood Mac's hit, "Don't Stop Thinking About Tomorrow." It struck him and me as exactly what I was trying to say. When I was in Los Angeles, I discussed the pros and cons of running with Hillary's friend, Mickey Cantor, who by then had become a close friend and trusted advisor of mine as well. When we started, Mickey said I should hire him for a dollar so our conversations would be privileged. A few days later, I sent him a check for a dollar with a note that said I had always wanted a high-priced lawyer and was sending the check in firm belief that you get what you pay for. I got a lot of good advice for that dollar, but I still didn't know what to do. Then came the phone call that changed things. One July day, Linda Dixon told me that Roger Porter was on the phone from the White House. As I've said, I had worked with Roger on the Education Goals Project and had a high regard for his ability to be loyal to the president and still work with the governors. Roger asked me if I was going to run for president in 1992. I told him I hadn't decided, that I was happier being governor than I'd been in years, that my family life was good, and I was reluctant to disrupt it, but that I thought the White House was being too passive in dealing with the country's economic and social problems. I said I thought the president should use the enormous political capital he had as a result of the Gulf War to tackle the country's big issues. After 5 or 10 minutes of what I thought was a serious conversation, Roger cut it off and got to the point. I'll never forget the first words of the message he had been designated to deliver. "Cut the crap, Governor." He said they had reviewed all the potential candidates against the president. Governor Cuomo was the most powerful speaker, but they could paint him as too liberal. All the senators could be defeated by attacks on their voting records. But I was different. With a strong record in economic development, education, and crime, and a strong DLC message, I actually had a chance to win. So if I ran, they would have to destroy me personally. "Here's how Washington works," he said. "The press has to have somebody in every election, and we're going to give them you." He went on to say the press were elitist who would believe any tales they were told about backwater Arkansas. "We'll spend whatever we have to spend to get whoever we have to get to say whatever they have to say to take you out. And we'll do it early." I tried to stay calm, but I was mad. I told Roger that what he had just said showed what was wrong with the administration. They had been in power so long they thought they were entitled to it. I said, "You think those parking spaces off the West Wing are yours, but they belong to the American people, and you have to earn the right to use them." I told Roger that what he had said made me more likely to run. Roger said that that was a nice sentiment, but he was calling as my friend to give me fair warning. If I waited until 1996, I could win the presidency. If I ran in 1992, they would destroy me, and my political career would be over. After the conversation ended, I called Hillary and told her about it. Then I told Mac McClarty. I never heard from or saw Roger Porter again until he attended a reception for the White House fellows when I was president. I wonder if he ever thinks about that phone call and whether it influenced my decision. Ever since I was a little boy, I have hated to be threatened. As a kid, I got shot by a BB gun and slugged by a much bigger boy because I wouldn't walk away from threats. In the campaign and for 8 years afterward, the Republicans would make good on theirs. And as Roger Porter had predicted, they got lots of help from some members of the press. Like the childhood BB shot in my leg and the roundhouse blow to my jaw, their attacks hurt. The lies hurt, and the occasional truth hurt more. I just tried to keep focused on the job at hand and the impact of my work on ordinary people. When I could do that, it was easier to stand up against those who craved power for its own sake. The next 3 months rushed by in a blur. At July 4th picnics in Northeast Arkansas, I saw the first Clinton for President signs, but was encouraged by some to wait until 1996 to run, and by others, who were angry at me for raising taxes again, not to run at all. When I went to Memphis for the dedication of the National Civil Rights Museum on the site of the Lorraine Motel where Martin Luther King Jr. was slain, several citizens urged me to run. But Jesse Jackson was still upset about the DLC, which he saw as conservative and divisive. I hated to be at cross purposes with Jesse, whom I admired, especially for his efforts to persuade black youngsters to stay in school and off drugs. Back in 1977, we had marked the 20th anniversary of the integration of Little Rock Central High with a joint appearance at the school, in which he told the students to open your brains and not your veins. Drugs and youth violence were still big issues in 1991. On July 12th, I traveled to Chicago to visit the public housing projects and see what they were doing to protect kids. In late July, I went to a Little Rock hospital to visit the black comedian Dick Gregory, who had been arrested for staging a sit-in in a store that sold drug paraphernalia, along with four members of a local anti-drug group, Dignity, doing in God's name incredible things yourself. The group was led by black ministers and the local leader of the black Muslims. It represented the kind of adult responsibility for solving our social problems that Jackson also espoused, the DLC advocated, and I thought was essential if we were going to turn things around. In August, the campaign began to take shape. I gave speeches in a number of places and formed an exploratory committee with Bruce Lindsay as treasurer. The committee allowed me to raise money to pay travel and other expenses without becoming a candidate. 2 weeks later, Bob Farmer of Boston, who had been Dukakis's chief fundraiser, resigned as treasurer of the Democratic National Committee to help me raise money. I began to get help from Frank Greer, an Alabama native, who in 1990 had produced television commercials for me that had both intellectual and emotional appeal, and Stan Greenberg, a pollster who had done focus groups for the 1990 campaign and had conducted extensive research on the so-called Reagan Democrats and what it would take to bring them home. I wanted Greenberg to be my pollster. I hated to give up Dick Morris, but by then he had become so involved with Republican candidates and office holders that he was compromised in the eyes of virtually all Democrats. After we set up the exploratory committee, Hillary, Chelsea, and I went to the summer meeting of the National Governors Association in Seattle. My colleagues had just voted me the most effective governor in the country in the annual survey conducted by Newsweek magazine, and several of them urged me to run. When the NGA meeting concluded, our family took a boat from Seattle to Canada for a short vacation in Victoria and Vancouver. As soon as I got home, I started touring the state, including a lot of unannounced stops to ask my constituents if I should run and whether they would release me from my pledge to serve my full term if I did. Most people said I should run if I thought it was the right thing to do, though few thought I had a chance to win. Senator Bumper, Senator Pryor, and our two Democratic congressmen, Ray Thornton and Beryl Anthony, all made supportive statements. Lieutenant Governor Jim Guy Tucker, House Speaker John Lipton, and Senate President Jerry Bookout assured me they would take care of the state in my absence. Hillary thought I should run. Mother was strongly in favor of it, and even Chelsea wasn't against it this time. I told her I'd be there for the important things, like her ballet performance in the Nutcracker at Christmas time, her school events, the trip to Renaissance weekend, and her birthday party. But I knew, too, that I'd miss some things, playing another duet with her on my sax at her piano recital, making Halloween stops with Chelsea in her always unique costume, reading to her at night, and helping with her homework. Being her father was the best job I ever had. I just hoped I could do it well enough in the long campaign ahead. When I wasn't around, I missed it as much as she did. But the telephone helped, and the fax machine did too. We sent a lot of math problems back and forth. Hillary would be gone less than I would, but when we were both away, Chelsea had a good support system in her grandparents, Carolyn Huber, the governor's mansion staff, and her friends and their parents. On August 21st, I got a big break when Senator Al Gore announced that he wouldn't run. He had run in 1988, and if he had run again in 1992, we would have split the vote in the southern states on Super Tuesday, March 10th, making it much harder for me to win. Al's only son, Albert, had been badly injured when he was hit by a car. Al decided he had to be there for his family during his son's long, hard recovery, a decision I understood and admired. In September, I visited Illinois again and spoke to the leading Democrats of Iowa, South Dakota, and Nebraska in Sioux City, Iowa, and to the Democratic National Committee in Los Angeles. The Illinois stop was particularly important because of the primary calendar. The nomination fight began with the Iowa caucuses, which I could pass up because Senator Tom Harkin of Iowa was running and was sure to win his home state. Then came New Hampshire, then South Carolina, then Maryland, Georgia, and Colorado. Then the 11 Super Tuesday southern states, then Illinois and Michigan on March 17th, St. Patrick's Day. Senator Gore's campaign had been derailed 4 years earlier when he didn't follow his impressive showing in the southern states with other victories. I thought I could win in Illinois for three reasons. Hillary was from there, I had worked in southern Illinois with the Delta Commission, and a number of prominent black leaders in Chicago had Arkansas roots. In Chicago, I met with two young political activists, David Wilhelm and David Axelrod, who would become involved in the campaign. They were idealistic, tempered by the fire of Chicago election battles, and in tune with my politics. Meanwhile, Kevin O'Keefe was driving all over the state, building the organization necessary to win. Michigan voted on the same day as Illinois, and I hope to do well there too, thanks to former Governor Jim Blanchard, Wayne County Executive Ed McNamara, and a lot of people, black and white, who had come to Michigan from Arkansas to work in the automobile plants. After Michigan and Illinois, the next big state to vote was New York, where my friend Harold Ickes was busy lining up support, and Paul Carey, son of former Governor Hugh Carey, was raising money. On September 6th, I finished organizing the governor's office for the campaign when Bill Bowen agreed to become my executive secretary. Bill was the president of Commercial National Bank, one of the state's most respected business leaders, and the prime organizer behind the so-called Good Suit Club, the business leaders who had supported the successful education program in the 1991 legislature. Bowen's appointment reassured people that the state's business would be well taken care of while I was away. In the weeks leading up to my announcement, I began to get a taste of the difference between running for president and a campaign for state office. First, abortion was a big issue because it was assumed that if President Bush were reelected, he would have enough Supreme Court vacancies to fill to secure a majority for reversing Roe versus Wade. I had always supported Roe, but opposed public funding of abortions for poor women, so my position didn't really please either side. It wasn't fair to poor women, but I had a hard time justifying funding abortions with the money of taxpayers who believed it was the equivalent of murder. Also, the question was really moot, since even the Democratic Congress had repeatedly failed to provide abortion funding. Besides abortion, there were the personal questions. When asked if I had ever smoked marijuana, I said I had never broken the drug laws in America. It was a tacit but awkward admission that I had tried it in England. There were also a lot of rumors about my personal life. On September 16th, at Mickey Cantor's and Frank Greer's urging, Hillary and I appeared at the Sperling Breakfast, a regular meeting of Washington journalists, to answer press questions. I didn't know if it was the right thing to do, but Mickey was persuasive. He argued that I had said before that I hadn't been perfect. People knew it, and you might as well tell them and try to take the sting out of what may or may not happen later in the campaign. When a reporter asked the question, I said that, like a lot of couples, we'd had problems, but we were committed to each other and our marriage was strong. Hillary backed me up. As far as I know, I was the only candidate who had ever said as much. It satisfied some of the reporters and columnists. For others, my candor simply confirmed that I was a good target. I'm still not sure if I did the right thing in going to the breakfast or in getting onto the slippery slope of answering personal questions. Character is important in a president. But as the contrasting examples of FDR and Richard Nixon show, marital perfection is not necessarily a good measure of presidential character. Moreover, that wasn't really the standard. In 1992, if you had violated your marriage vows, gotten divorced, and remarried, the infidelity wasn't considered disqualifying or even newsworthy, while couples who stayed married were fair game, as if divorce was always the more authentic choice. Given the complexity of people's lives and the importance of both parents in raising children, that's probably not the right standard. Notwithstanding the personal questions, I got more than my fair share of favorable press coverage in the early days from thoughtful journalists who were interested in my ideas and policies and in what I had done as governor. I also knew I could start the campaign with a core of enthusiastic supporters across the country, thanks to the friends Hillary and I had made over the years and lots of Arkansans who were willing to travel to other states to campaign for me. They were undeterred by the fact that I was virtually unknown to the American people and far behind in the polls. So was I. Unlike 1987, this time I was ready. Chapter 26. October 3rd was a beautiful autumn morning in Arkansas, crisp and clear. I started the day that would change my life in the usual way, with an early morning jog. I went out the back gate of the governor's mansion, through the old Quapaw Quarter, then downtown to the old State House. The grand old place where I had held my first reception when I was sworn in as Attorney General in 1977 was already decked out in American flags. After I ran past it, turned and headed for home, I saw a newspaper vending machine. Through the glass, I could read the headline, "Hour Arrives for Clinton." On the way home, several passers-by wished me well. Back at the mansion, I took a last look at my announcement speech. I had worked on it until well past midnight. It was full of what I felt was good rhetoric and specific policy proposals, but still too long, so I cut a few lines. At noon, I was introduced on the stage by our state treasurer, Jimmy Lou Fisher, who had been with me since 1978. I started out a little awkwardly, probably because of the conflicting feelings flooding through me. I was at once reluctant to abandon the life I knew and eager for the challenge. A little afraid, but sure I was doing the right thing. I spoke for more than half an hour, thanking my family, friends, and supporters for giving me the strength to step beyond a life and job I love to make a commitment to a larger cause, preserving the American dream, restoring the hopes of the forgotten middle class, reclaiming the future for our children. I closed with a pledge to give new life to the American dream by forming a new covenant with the people. More opportunity for all, more responsibility from everyone, and a greater sense of common purpose. When it was over, I felt elated and excited, but maybe relieved more than anything else, especially after Chelsea wisecracked, "Nice speech, Governor." Hillary and I spent the rest of the day receiving well-wishers, and Mother, Dick, and Roger all seemed happy about it, as did Hillary's family. Mother acted as if she knew I would win. As well as I knew her, I couldn't be sure if it was truly how she felt, or just another example of her game face. That night, we gathered around the piano with old friends. Carolyn Staley played, just as she had done since we were 15. We sang Amazing Grace and other hymns, and lots of songs from the 60s, including Abraham, Martin, and John, a tribute to the fallen heroes of our generation. I went to bed believing we could cut through the cynicism and despair and rekindle the fire those men had lit in my heart. Governor Mario Cuomo once said, "We campaign in poetry, but we govern in prose." The statement is basically accurate, but a lot of campaigning is prose, too. Putting together the nuts and bolts, going through the required rituals, and responding to the press. Day two of the campaign was more prose than poetry. A series of interviews designed to get me on television nationally and in major local markets, and to answer the threshold question of why I had gone back on my commitment to finish my term, and whether that meant I was untrustworthy. I answered the questions as best I could and moved on to the campaign message. It was all prosaic, but it got us to day three. The rest of the year was full of the frantic activity of a late-starting campaign, getting organized, raising money, reaching out to specific constituencies, and working New Hampshire. Our first headquarters was in an old paint store on 7th Street near the Capitol. I had decided to base the campaign out of Little Rock instead of Washington. It made travel arrangements a little more complicated, but I wanted to stick close to my roots and to get home often enough to be with my family and handle official business that required my presence. But staying in Arkansas also had another big benefit. It helped our young staff keep focused on the work at hand. They weren't distracted by the pervasive Washington rumor mill, and they didn't get too carried away by the surprisingly favorable press coverage I received early in the campaign, or too depressed by the torrent of negative press soon to come. After a few weeks, we had outgrown the paint store and moved nearby to the old office of the Department of Higher Education, which we used until we outgrew it, too, just before the Democratic Convention. Then we moved again, downtown to the Arkansas Gazette building, which had become vacant a few months earlier upon the purchase and subsequent dismantling of the Gazette by the owner of the Arkansas Democrat, Walter Hussman. The Gazette building would be our home for the rest of the campaign, which from my point of view was the only good result of the loss of the oldest independent newspaper in America west of the Mississippi. The Gazette had stood for civil rights in the 50s and 60s and had staunchly supported Dale Bumpers, David Pryor, and me in our efforts to modernize education, social services, and the economy. In its glory days, it was one of the best papers in the country, bringing well-written and wide-ranging national and international stories to readers in the far corners of our state. In the 1980s, the Gazette began to face competition from Hussman's Arkansas Democrat, which until then had been a much smaller afternoon paper. The newspaper war that followed had a foreordained outcome because Hussman owned other profitable media properties, which allowed him to absorb tremendous operating losses at the Democrat in order to take advertising and subscribers away from the Gazette. Not long before I announced for president, Hussman acquired the Gazette and consolidated its operations into his paper, renaming it the Arkansas Democrat Gazette. Over the years, the Democrat Gazette would help to make Arkansas a more Republican state. The overall tone of its editorial page was conservative and highly critical of me, often in very personal terms. In this, the paper faithfully reflected the views of its publisher. Though I was sad to see the Gazette fall, I was glad to have the building. Perhaps I was hoping that the ghosts of its progressive past would keep us fighting for tomorrow. We started out with an all-Arkansas staff, with Bruce Lindsay as campaign director and Craig Smith, who had handled my appointments to boards and commissions, as finance director. Rodney Slater and Carol Willis were already hard at work contacting black political, religious, and business leaders across the country. My old friend, Eli Siegel, agreed to help me build a national staff. I had already met with one person I was sure I wanted on the team, a talented young staffer for Congressman Dick Gephardt, the Democratic Majority Leader. George Stephanopoulos, the son of a Greek Orthodox priest, was a Rhodes Scholar who had previously worked for my friend Father Tim Healy when he ran the New York Public Library. I liked George immediately and knew he could serve as a bridge to the national press and the congressional Democrats, as well as make a contribution to thinking through the intellectual challenges of the campaign. Eli met with him, confirmed my judgment, and George came to work as deputy campaign manager in charge of communications. Eli also saw David Wilhelm, the young Chicago political operative whom I wanted on the team. We offered him the job of campaign manager, and he quickly accepted. David was, in political language, a twofer. Besides managing the overall campaign, he would be a special help in Illinois. I was convinced that with David as campaign manager, along with Kevin O'Keefe as a state organizer, we could now win a clear victory in Illinois to follow up on the anticipated sweep of the southern states on Super Tuesday. Soon afterward, we also persuaded another young Chicagoan, Rahm Emanuel, to join our campaign. Rahm had worked with Wilhelm in the successful campaigns of Mayor Richard Daley and Senator Paul Simon. He was a slight, intense man who had studied ballet and, though an American citizen, had served in the Israeli army. Rahm was so aggressive, he made me look laid back. We made him finance director, a job in which an underfunded campaign needs an aggressor. Craig Smith went to work on our state campaign organizations, a job better suited to his considerable political skills. Soon, Bruce Reed left the Democratic Leadership Council to become our policy director. Eli also interviewed two women who would play important roles in the campaign. Dee Dee Myers from California became the press secretary, a job that would require her to handle more incoming fire than she possibly could have anticipated. Though she was very young, she rose to the challenge. Stephanie Celine from Washington State became our political director. She was married to Frank Greer, but that's not why I hired her. Stephanie was smart, politically astute, and less hard-edged than most of the boys. She provided both the good work and the good chemistry every high-tension effort needs. As the campaign progressed, young people from all over America just showed up to pick up the extra load. On the financial front, we made do in the beginning with generous early help from Arkansans, Bob Farmer's efforts in Massachusetts, and with regular Democratic donors who would give just because he asked them, and donations from friends around the country that helped me qualify for matching funds from the federal government. To do that, a candidate must raise $5,000 in each of 20 states in amounts not exceeding $250 per contribution. In some states, my governor friends took care of it. In Texas, my longtime supporter Truman Arnold raised a much-needed $30,000. Unlike many wealthy people, Truman seemed to become an even more committed Democrat as he got richer. Somewhat surprisingly, a lot of people in the Washington, D.C. area wanted to help. In particular, Democratic lawyer and fundraiser Vic Razor and my friend from Renaissance Weekend, Tom Schneider. In New York, I got invaluable early help, not only from our friends Harold Ickes and Susan Thomases, but also from Ken Brody, a Goldman Sachs executive who decided he wanted to get heavily involved in Democratic politics for the first time. Ken told me he had been a Republican because he thought the Democrats had a heart, but their head was in the wrong place. Then he said he had gotten close enough to the National Republicans to see that they had a head but no heart, and decided to join the Democrats because he thought it was easier to change minds than hearts, and luckily for me, he figured I was the best place to start. Ken took me to dinner with high-powered New York business people, including Bob Rubin, whose tightly reasoned arguments for a new economic policy made a lasting impression on me. In every successful political campaign, people like Ken Brody somehow appear, bringing energy, ideas, and converts. In addition to money raising and organizing, I had to reach out to constituencies that were predominantly Democratic. In October, I spoke to a Jewish group in Texas saying that Israel should trade land for peace, to blacks and Hispanics in Chicago, and to Democratic Party groups in Tennessee, Maine, New Jersey, and California, all of which were considered swing states, meaning they could go either way in the general election. In November, I spoke in Memphis to the Convention of the Church of God in Christ, America's fastest-growing black denomination. I worked the South, Florida, South Carolina, Louisiana, and Georgia. Florida was important because its December 15th straw poll at the Democratic Convention would be the first contested vote. President Bush was beginning to slip in the polls and didn't help himself by saying that the economy was in good shape. I spoke to the National Education Association and the annual meeting of the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee in Washington. I went south again to North Carolina, Texas, and Georgia. In the West, I made stops in Colorado and South Dakota, in Wyoming, where Governor Mike Sullivan endorsed me, and in the Republican stronghold of Orange County, California, where I picked up the support of Republican telecommunications executive Roger Johnson and others who were disillusioned with President Bush's economic policy. While all this was going on, however, the main focus of the campaign was New Hampshire. If I ran poorly there, I might not do well enough in the states that followed to last until Super Tuesday. Though I was running dead last in the polls in mid-November, I liked my chances. New Hampshire is a small state, less than half the size of Arkansas, with very well-informed primary voters who take seriously their responsibility to carefully evaluate the candidates and their positions. To compete effectively, a good organization and persuasive television ads are necessary, but nowhere near sufficient. You must also do well in an endless stream of small house parties, town meetings, rallies, and unscheduled handshaking. A lot of New Hampshire citizens won't vote for anyone who hasn't personally asked for their support. After all my years in Arkansas politics, that kind of campaigning was second nature to me. Even more than the political culture, the economic distress and the inevitable emotional trauma it spawned made me feel at home in New Hampshire. It was like Arkansas 10 years earlier. After prospering throughout the 1980s, New Hampshire had the nation's fastest-growing welfare and food stamp rolls and the highest rate of bankruptcies. Factories were closing and banks were in trouble. Lots of people were unemployed and genuinely afraid of losing their homes and their health insurance. They didn't know if they would be able to send their kids to college. They doubted Social Security would be solvent when they reached their retirement years. I knew how they felt. I had known many Arkansans in similar situations. And I thought I knew what needed to be done to turn things around. The campaign organization began with two gifted young people, Mitchell Schwartz and Wendy Smith, who moved to Manchester and opened the state headquarters. They were soon joined by Michael Whooley, a Boston Irishman and world-class organizer, and my friend of 40 years, Patty Howe Kreiner, who moved up from Little Rock to explain and defend me and my record. Before long, we had a big steering committee co-chaired by two lawyers I'd met through the DLC, John Broderick and Terry Shoemaker, whose office fortuitously was in the same building that more than a century earlier had housed the law office of Governor Franklin Pierce. The competition was stiff. All the announced candidates were running hard in New Hampshire. Senator Bob Kerrey, the Medal of Honor winner and former Nebraska governor, attracted a lot of interest because he was a political maverick, a fiscal conservative, and a social liberal. The centerpiece of his campaign was a sweeping proposal to provide health coverage for all Americans, a big issue in a state where the number of people losing their health insurance was rising daily after a decade in which the cost of health insurance nationally had risen at 3 times the overall rate of inflation. Kerry also had a powerful argument that his military record and his popularity in conservative Republican Nebraska made him the most electable Democrat against President Bush. Senator Tom Harkin of Iowa was the Senate's leading advocate for the rights of the disabled, an authority on science and technology issues which were important to the growing number of New Hampshire suburban voters, and a longtime ally of the labor movement. He argued that it would take an authentic populist campaign to win in November, not a DLC message, which he said had no appeal to real Democrats. Former Senator Paul Tsongas of Lowell, Massachusetts, had retired at a young age from a successful career in the Senate to battle cancer. He had become a fitness fanatic who swam vigorously and publicly to demonstrate that he was cured and able to be president. Tsongas argued that his premature brush with mortality had liberated him from conventional political constraints, making him more willing than the rest of us to tell voters hard truths they didn't necessarily want to hear. He had some interesting ideas, which he put forth in a widely distributed campaign booklet. Governor Doug Wilder had made history by becoming Virginia's first African-American governor. He argued that his ability to win in a conservative southern state and his record on education, crime, and balanced budgets proved his electability. Soon after I entered the race, former Governor Jerry Brown of California also announced. Jerry said he wouldn't take contributions in amounts over $100 and tried to position himself as the only genuine reformer in the race. The focus of his campaign became a proposal to scrap the complex tax code in favor of a uniform flat tax of 13% on all Americans. In 1976, as a young governor, Jerry entered the late primaries and won several of them in a last-minute effort to stop Jimmy Carter. In 1979, I served with him in the National Governors Association, where I came to appreciate his quick mind and often unusual analysis of current events. The only quality his unique political persona lacked was a sense of humor. I liked Jerry, but he took every conversation awfully seriously. For more than 2 months after I announced, the campaign was shadowed by the specter that there might be yet another candidate, Governor Mario Cuomo of New York. Cuomo was a huge figure in Democratic politics, our finest orator and a passionate defender of Democratic values during the Reagan-Bush years. Many people thought the nomination was his for the asking, and for a good while, I thought he would ask. He took some hard shots at the DLC, at me, and my ideas on welfare reform and national service. I was magnanimous in public, but I fumed in private and said some things about Mario I regret. I think I was so stung by his criticism because I had always admired him. In mid-December, he finally announced that he wouldn't run. When some of my hard comments about him became public during the New Hampshire primary, all I could do was apologize. Thank goodness he was big enough to accept it. In the years ahead, Mario Cuomo would become a valued advisor and one of my strongest defenders. I wanted to put him on the Supreme Court, but he didn't want that job either. I think he loved his life in New York too much to give it up, a fact the voters didn't fully appreciate when they denied him a fourth term in 1994. At the outset of the campaign, I thought my strongest competitor in New Hampshire would be Harkin or Kerry. Before long, it was clear that I was mistaken. Tsongas was the man to beat. His hometown was practically on the New Hampshire state line. He had a compelling life story. He demonstrated the toughness and determination to win, and most important, he was the only other candidate who was competing with me on the essential battleground of ideas, message, and specific comprehensive proposals. Successful presidential campaigns require three basic things. First, people have to be able to look at you and imagine you as president. Then you have to have enough money and support to become known. After that, it's a battle of ideas, message, and issues. Tsongas met the first two criteria and was out to win the ideas battle. I was determined not to let him do it. I scheduled three speeches at Georgetown to flesh out my new covenant theme with specific proposals. They were delivered to students, faculty, supporters, and good press coverage in beautiful old wood-paneled Gaston Hall in the Healy Building. On October 23rd, the topic was responsibility and community. On November 20th, economic opportunity. On December 12th, national security. Together, these speeches allowed me to articulate the ideas and proposals I had developed over the previous decade as governor and with the Democratic Leadership Council. I had helped to write and deeply believed in the DLC's five core beliefs. Andrew Jackson's credo of opportunity for all and special privileges for none. The basic American values of work and family, freedom and responsibility, faith, tolerance, and inclusion. John Kennedy's ethic of mutual responsibility, asking citizens to give something back to their country. The advancement of democratic and humanitarian values around the world, and prosperity and upward mobility at home. And Franklin Roosevelt's commitment to innovation, to modernizing government for the information age, and encouraging people by giving them the tools to make the most of their own lives. I was amazed by some of the criticisms of the DLC from the Democratic left, who accused us of being closet Republicans, and from some members of the political press who had comfortable little boxes marked Democrat and Republican. When we didn't fit neatly in their ossified Democratic box, they said we didn't believe in anything. The proof was that we wanted to win national elections, something Democrats apparently weren't supposed to do. I believe the DLC was furthering the best values and principles of the Democratic Party with new ideas. Of course, some liberals honestly disagreed with us on welfare reform, trade, fiscal responsibility, and national defense. But our differences with the Republicans were clear. We were against their unfair tax cuts and big deficits, their opposition to the family and medical leave bill and the Brady bill, their failure to adequately fund education or push proven reforms instead of vouchers, their divisive tactics on racial and gay issues, their unwillingness to protect the environment, their anti-choice stance, and much more. We also had good ideas, like putting 100,000 community police on the streets, doubling the earned income tax credit to make work more attractive and life better for families with modest incomes, and offering young people a chance to do community service in return for assistance to pay for college. The principles and proposals I advocated could hardly be called Republican light or lacking in conviction. Instead, they helped to modernize the Democratic Party and later would be adopted by resurgent center-left parties all over the world in what would be called the Third Way. Most important, the new ideas, when implemented, would prove to be good for America. The 1991 Georgetown speeches gave me the invaluable opportunity to demonstrate that I had a comprehensive agenda for change and was serious about implementing it. Meanwhile, back in New Hampshire, I put out a campaign booklet of my own, outlining all the specific proposals made in the Georgetown speeches, and I scheduled as many town meetings as possible. One of the early ones was held in Keene, a beautiful college town in the southern part of the state. Our campaign workers had put up flyers around town, but we didn't know how many people would show up. The room we rented held about 200. On the way to the meeting, I asked a veteran campaigner how many people we needed to avoid embarrassment. She said, 50. And how many to be judged a success? 150. When we arrived, there were 400 people. The fire marshal made us put half of them in another room, and I had to do two meetings. It was the first time I knew we could do well in New Hampshire. Usually I talked for 15 minutes or so and spent an hour or more answering questions. At first I worried about being too detailed and policy wonky in the answers, but I soon realized that people were looking for substance over style. They were really hurting and wanted to understand what was happening to them and how they could get out of the fix they were in. I learned a lot just listening to the questions I got from people at those town meetings and other campaign stops. An elderly couple, Edward and Annie Davis, told me they often had to choose between buying their prescription drugs and buying food. A high school student said her unemployed father was so ashamed he couldn't look at his family over dinner. He just hung his head. I met veterans in American Legion halls and found they were more concerned with the deterioration of health care at Veterans Administration hospitals than with my opposition to the Vietnam War. I was especially moved by the story of Ron Machos, whose son Ronnie was born with a heart problem. He had lost his job in the recession and couldn't find another one with health insurance to cover the large medical costs he knew were coming. When the New Hampshire Democrats held a convention to hear from all the candidates, a group of students carrying a Clinton for President banner, who had been recruited by their teacher, my old friend from Arkansas, Jan Pascal, led me to the podium. One of them made a particular impression on me. Michael Morrison was in a wheelchair, but it didn't slow him down. He was supporting me because he was being raised by a single mother on a modest income, and he thought I was committed to giving all kids a chance to go to college and get a good job. By December, the campaign was on a roll. On December 2nd, James Carville and his partner Paul Bagala joined us. They were colorful characters and a hot political property, having recently helped elect Governor Bob Casey and Senator Harris Wofford in Pennsylvania, and Governor Zell Miller in Georgia. Zell first got Carville on the phone for me so that I could set up a meeting with him and Bagala. Like Frank Gehry and me, they were part of an endangered but hardy political species, white Southern Democrats. Carville was a Louisiana Cajun and ex-Marine who had a great strategic sense and a deep commitment to progressive politics. He and I had a lot in common, including strong-willed, down-to-earth mothers whom we adored. Bagala was a witty dynamo from Sugarland, Texas, who blended aggressive populism with his Catholic social conscience. I wasn't the only candidate who wanted to hire them, and when they signed on, they brought energy, focus, and credibility to our efforts. On December 10th, I spoke to the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations, and 2 days later, I delivered the third and final Georgetown speech on national security. I got a lot of help with the speeches from my longtime friend, Sandy Berger, who had been deputy director of policy planning in the State Department during the Carter years. Sandy recruited three other Carter-era foreign policy experts to help: Tony Lake, Dick Holbrooke, and Madeleine Albright, along with a bright Australian-born expert on the Middle East, Martin Indyk. All would play important roles in the years ahead. In mid-December, it was enough that they helped me cross the threshold of understanding and competence in foreign affairs. On December 15th, I won the non-binding Florida straw poll at the State Democratic Convention with 54% of the delegates. I knew many of them from my three visits to the convention in the 1980s, and I had by far the strongest campaign organization, headed by Lieutenant Governor Buddy McKay. Hillary and I also worked the delegates hard, as did her brothers Hugh and Tony, who lived in Miami, and Hugh's wife Maria, a Cuban-American lawyer. 2 days after the Florida win, an Arkansas fundraiser netted $800,000 for the campaign, far more than had ever before been raised at a single event there. On December 19th, the Nashville Banner became the first newspaper to endorse me. On December 20th, Governor Cuomo said he wouldn't run. Then Senator Sam Nunn and Governor Zell Miller of Georgia gave the campaign a huge boost when they endorsed me. Georgia's primary came just before Super Tuesday, along with Maryland's and Colorado's. Meanwhile, President Bush's troubles mounted as Pat Buchanan announced his intention to enter the GOP primaries with a George Wallace-like attack on the president from the right. Conservative Republicans were upset with the president for signing a $492 billion deficit reduction package passed by the Democratic Congress because, in addition to spending cuts, it contained a 5-cent gas tax increase. Bush had brought the Republican convention to its feet in 1988 with his famous line, "Read my lips, no new taxes." He did the responsible thing in signing the deficit reduction package, but in doing so, he broke his most visible campaign commitment and violated the anti-tax theology of his party's right-wing base. The conservatives didn't direct all their fire at the president. I got my fair share, too. From a group called ARIUS, which stood for Alliance for the Rebirth of an Independent American Spirit. ARIUS was led in part by Cliff Jackson, an Arkansan whom I'd known and liked at Oxford, but who was now a conservative Republican with a deep personal animosity toward me. When ARIUS ran TV, radio, and newspaper ads attacking my record, we responded quickly and aggressively. The attacks might have done the campaign more good than harm because answering them highlighted my accomplishments as governor and because the source of the attacks made them suspect among New Hampshire Democrats. 2 days before Christmas, a New Hampshire poll placed me second to Paul Tsongas and closing fast. The year ended on a good note.